Thank you so much for bringing us here. I've had the great pleasure of talking with Hakeem on the phone a couple times, and I'll leave you like that. But anyway, I want to ask you a couple things about the slides. In one, you were at a school, it was the opening day, and I was curious if it was a school for boys and girls, or boys or girls. And my other question is, in that training program for men to become educated about how to treat women, how did they get men to show up to that? I mean, are men interested in learning that, or how did that happen?
You want to do the first one?
Yeah, I didn't visit that school, so I don't know if that was the school that I visited. Though it was the girls would go during the first half of the day, and the boys would attend during the last half of the day. So at some schools they're mixed, at some schools they're separated. It just sort of depends. And at all the schools in Afghanistan, you have to learn the Quran, I think, 2 hours a week. Yeah. So there's compulsory Muslim education.
And that, I think that school in particular was a response to one, a girl school that was burned down. And they chose a different location and used some of the same domes to rebuild a school in a neighborhood not too far away. But we went to the original site that was burned and bombed, and it was kind of tragic. So they just wanted the fresh new site to get everything back together. And I think they're going to try to do girls and boys there. It was mostly boys that were out there. A lot of times we were only able to just meet groups of boys and men, and the women in the delegation would go meet with the groups of women in another location. Just like Hakeem was saying, it's a very conservative society, or traditional, whatever word you want to use, so a lot of those lines are very clearly defined. You had another part to your question.
The training program for men to rethink about how to treat women.
It's,
where did the men come from? How did they sign up?
Well, there was an outreach center in town, and that in the building that was in, that building was actually burned down by the Taliban, and you could see the ceiling was charred. It was all black, and you can see where it was on fire. And it didn't have any walls or anything, but they still used it to educate. And it was an organization, a human development skills organization, that had been there for a while, probably almost 10 years. And people over there are eager to learn and to be educated. It didn't seem as if anyone was there against their will. Everyone at the end of the ceremony was coming up to us with their certificates and wanted us to take pictures of them. They were very proud of what they had done. Although it probably is going to take more than 3 days of training to create a generational change, it is definitely a beginning, and it's a positive sign.
Another person we met was Aziz from the Afghan Friendship Coordination Organization. He used to work for the American Friends Service Committee. And he was talking about the problem of the United Nations Human Rights Commission and other human rights groups like that having these classes for women, telling them that they have human rights and this is their human rights and things, and it actually caused problems because the men felt like their rights are being taken away because they thought it's their right to dominate their wives. And so what they found is that these human rights programs are actually creating more conflict. They're causing an increase in domestic abuse and things like that. And so he's using what they call a psychosocial approach, and they are having courses similar to that where they're, instead of just telling them, like, these are your human rights, they're also, they're having spouses and men and women go through these courses where they can deal with their conflict in a responsible sort of way, I guess. And it's actually very successful. And they use the same approach for other issues, like if the USAID goes and builds a well in a village, it'll cause conflict between the different tribes arguing over who gets to use the well or not. And so they use the psychosocial approach for that too. And it's also successful there, so.
What was the name of the organization again?
the American, the Afghan Friendship Coordination Organization. They have a website. It's AFC. I think it's just AFCO.org. I think.
Mike.
If American and Allied forces were to leave, and if the Afghan people wanted to resist the Taliban and wanted to put in a democratic government and wanted to resist the warlords, do they have any means of doing so that might have a chance of being effective, either peacefully or violently, in your opinion?
Well, I'm gonna answer this question with the voices that I heard while I was there. And the majority of the voices were pleading for us not to leave, contrary to what we think. Were pleading for us not to leave.
Oh.
They want us there. Which was, you know, hard for me to hear over and over and over, but eventually I had to come to reality with what I was hearing and accept that I had to come back and say it. But I'll move on to the next part of that question. Can they repel the Taliban if the Taliban comes back? The Taliban is arguably defeated, gone. It's a shell of what it used to be. And the ANA, the Afghan National Army, and the AMP is a significant armed force now on both sides of the fence, and can probably handle the situation themselves as best as it can be handled by organizations on the ground. Now, the democratic government part, there's something that I commonly heard while I was over there, and that was, if this is what democracy looks like, we don't want it, which is completely understandable. And there's, when we think about transplanting democracy to Afghanistan, we don't think about how their social structure, their legal codes, and their idea of a governing body is based on Islamic law. And that provides the foundations for how they govern across most of the tribes, and even in a centralized way. You know, their constitution has a lot of Sharia law built into it. So can it be our idea of democracy, and will that be functional? Probably not, because that's kind of hegemonic in a way. So it has to be their own way, really, if it's going to be something that's genuine to who they are as people. And this is, you know, something that I heard over and over from them. I know there was at least two more parts to your question beyond that, but
So given what you just said, do you think that it's possible for the Afghan people, if we were to leave, to institute the kind of society that they themselves would want?
Well, I'm going to have to quote someone that I gained a lot of respect for while I was there, Archibald. And that is that Afghanistan is not ready to stand on its own two feet. It doesn't have the institutions that are needed to support a nation that is going to try to stand on its own two feet. So if we pull out, it's going to be disastrous. The main reason, the United States chose sides in the Civil War when we went in. We chose to align with ex-Mujahideen in the Northern Alliance and to fight against the Taliban. And that was a Civil War that was already happening, and is the Civil War that hasn't ended. So it's probably going to exist whenever we do get out of the way, because it was never resolved in the first place. So the short answer to the series of questions you asked is that it's okay to be confused about Afghanistan, because it's a very complicated situation, and there's no clear answer. Not even the Afghan. The Afghans are just as confused about it as we are, which is really sad. But it's a point of unity for our two citizenries, you know? We're both stuck in the middle of something that none of us understand, and we don't know what to do.
Before I went, I mean, I'm still against the war, but before I went, it was easy for me to say I'm against the war. Once I was there, it felt awkward, because I always thought that if the war ends, there's probably going to be an exacerbated conflict. And what we heard from everyone, I'd say about half of the people wanted us to stay. Half the people wanted us to go. They were unanimous that there shouldn't be any air raids. Unanimous there shouldn't be night raids. The detention process should be turned over to the Afghans. And most of them didn't think there should be targeted killings either, even targeted killings of Taliban. But about half of the people wanted us to stay, and half the people wanted us to go. But even among the people who wanted us to go, they were very aware that if we leave, there's going to be either a bloodbath, chaos, and or a full-blown civil war. And there's already a civil war, but a civil war to the degree that we had, that they had in the early 90s, where you had 25,000 civilians in Kabul dying in a single bombardment. And this is something, and there were people that we met that were doing amazing work for peace, but felt like if we leave, whatever space they have to do their work is going to be gone, because there's going to be chaos or a bloodbath or whatever. And that was something that was very difficult for me to hear, but it's what we heard. And but we met a man who was the education director of an orphanage, who said, you know, over half of the population is 18 and under, and 10 years from now they're going to be running this country, and all the older people are going to be gone. And the American friendship guy said, the sooner they can die, the better. I hope they all die soon of old age. And that what we need to be doing is focusing on the children. And he said, the adults are going to continue to do what the adults do, but they're not going to be there forever, and the kids are going to take over, and those are the people that we need to be focusing on. And I think that is the question that I focus on now, is how do we create a situation in Afghanistan that just create, it's a situation where war is not sustainable there anymore. And I think supporting groups like the Afghan Youth Peace Volunteers and the work of this other gentleman that we met, Ahmadullah Archiwal, who he just quoted, if we support this sort of work, then it's going to create a condition where the American occupation can leave without flinching, and they can leave behind a country where the Taliban can't take over. And it makes it difficult for corruption to continue to take hold of the country.
Siri, did you have a...
I did. I just wanted to ask you how people responded specifically to you as former soldiers there, and if there was some common thread in the things they wanted to say to you.
I was actually very... felt very uncomfortable being there, but no one ever confronted me or had any sort of negative attitude towards me whatsoever. And they interviewed me on my last day, and they said that it's very important that Afghans hear what you have to say as a U.S. veteran. And that was really weird for me to hear. I thought, why would they want to listen to me? After what I've done. But they were a very forgiving group of kids. And like I said, because so many people depend on Americans, and also because it's Kabul, there wasn't a lot of backlash at all. Plus they wanted money. And we had money that they could come up and beg for and things.
You have a question? Or a question? Do you think if we minimized our strictly military presence, and instead sent military construction battalions and engineering outfits and stuff like that to build things, do you think that would also fulfill their desire for us to still be there, or do they believe that they need guys running around with M16s and stuff like that? from the U.S.?
Well,
I mean, if we were building instead of fighting, do you think that would be acceptable to the people who live there?
I think it would be acceptable, but at the same time, it's kind of insulting because they know how to build their own buildings and their own roads.
Well, yeah, but we could provide resources they don't have, you know, equipment and stuff like that.
Yeah, definitely. But for the most part, the desire to have us armed and present comes from the things like the death dance, like he was describing. Yeah. There's a collective body of trauma in Afghanistan, and people haven't forgotten what it was like. And that's the scariest thing in the world, of that possibly coming back into their reality. So a lot of that is based off a collectively traumatized citizenry who still understands what it's like when that happens. And that, for the most part, was the main reason they wanted armed people hanging around, because they didn't want that to come back. As far as rebuilding their country, they're pretty self-sufficient, autonomous people. And they pride themselves on that. Now, I think in terms of what if we laid down our weapons and stood behind them as villagers, as equals, and died with them through something like that, would they be able to stand with us and respect us? And yeah, I think that would change things. I think we could earn a little bit of respect because there's all this honor and glory around dying for your country, but it's only honorable if you do it with a weapon in your hand. You know, if it was done non-violently, but with the same courage, I think that might leave a lasting impression.
They have something similar to that. It's called Provincial Reconstruction Teams, PRTs. And it's one of the major elements of the counterinsurgency strategy is doing these sorts of projects, reconstruction projects. But the Taliban is very aware that USAID and these PRTs are an extension of a military strategy. And so they specifically target this sort of aid. There was a study that Oxfam did, signed by a whole bunch of NGOs. And what they found was that in 2010, I believe it was 60-something aid workers were killed, and all of them except for like two were in USAID. And of the 60-something aid workers that were kidnapped, all of them were released unharmed because they were not affiliated with the United States. Because the Taliban went to the village elders, and the village elders vouched for them and said that they're independent. Because the Pashtuns value charity, but they also value resisting all forms of occupation at all costs, to their deaths. So as Jacob said, if we all lay down our arms, maybe they would accept it and see it as charity. But that's not going to happen, probably, unless civilians went there.
About a year ago, the Vesta Peace Fund surveyed a talk by a guy named Khan Hallinan. And he writes for The Nation, and he talked about, you know, what one of the benefits would be for the U.S. military presence there is regarding a natural gas pipeline across northern Afghanistan, which would allow the United States not to have to deal with Iran, et cetera, et cetera. So it's kind of the geopolitical thing going down. I'm curious if any of the people you ran into had another perspective at that level, or if they were just like so dealing with the nuts and bolts of the situation. And the other question is, we're opposed to the Afghanistan presence. I see Afghanistan Veterans Against the War. I hear you saying the Afghanistan people want us there because they're scared. Was there any possibility of perhaps a non-United States force being able to perhaps be a more honest peacemaker there that would have more credibility? Was there any discussion along those lines? You know, okay, so maybe the United States pulls out, you know, we're half a planet away, and some folks more local, you know, multinational force could try and keep things calm.
I'll try and answer your question real quick. The first one, there was some talk about pipelines. There wasn't a lot of it, but there was some. And actually, our driver talked about how he has a friend who works on Bagram Air Base, and he was claiming that America is getting uranium from around that area to the tune of tens of billions of dollars worth of uranium. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what he was saying. And as for the second part of your question, there were some who talked about the idea of having, for example, a peacekeeping force of Muslim nations, like Turkey. For example, Barshadost, do you remember his full name? Barshadost, he's a presidential candidate in Afghanistan. He's considered to be the cleanest presidential candidate. He tours around Afghanistan in a tent. He lives in a tent. He's known as the Gandhi, the Afghanistan Gandhi, that's what they call him. But he thinks that there should be a peacekeeping force of Muslim nations. So that's one possibility.
Actually, I wanted to expand on the last question about the international, like you said, geopolitical issues, because I don't know if this is still going on, but I know that for a long time Pakistan said that they were not going to give up the Taliban because they were using the Taliban in the Northwest Frontier Province to keep the border skirmish going with India, mm-hmm. and also the pipeline that the other gentleman mentioned.
And also so that they can get supplies in from Central Asia to Pakistan.
Yeah. And also the fact that whoever is running the country, they've got to protect and keep the opium trade going, or else the entire lots of U.S. banks would fail because they need to launder drug money for the Afghani banks or whatever country like Colombia to make their dollar-denominated payments to the U.S. banks. Then the money gets into the stock market, and so it's actually the illegal drug trade is an important part of our covert economy, and it's always protected by the intelligence agencies and the military, and I was wondering how much they were hip to that and what they saw as, how to deal with that.
Well, everyone that we talked to in Afghanistan who's aware of what's happening in Afghanistan is very much aware that Pakistan plays a large role in destabilizing Afghanistan, and it's no mystery. So even if we do have an international Muslim peacekeeping force in Afghanistan, the root issues are that the countries surrounding Afghanistan have a vested interest in destabilizing Afghanistan. So stabilization can't just be something that we focus on in Afghanistan. We have to look at the entire region and how to stop this type of behavior. We can't actually do that, but that's what has to be looked at instead of, we just need a peacekeeping force in Afghanistan and things are going to be okay. That's not necessarily the truth. Now, why is Pakistan and Iran so interested in making sure Afghanistan is destabilized? Who knows? It's everyone's best guess. There's a lot of reasons, geopolitical reasons, but the short answer to your question is, yes, Pakistan's heavily involved in Afghanistan. When I went to Afghanistan in 2001, I started off in Uzbekistan and then pushed down into Afghanistan. And when I went back in 2002, I spent the whole time on the Pakistan border, all over the place. So even back in 2002, we were very much aware that most of the anti-occupation forces were in Pakistan. And it's a seasonal war where they come across the border after they've armed and outfitted themselves and rested for a little while and gathered their energy and strength in Pakistan and come over in the spring and summer when it's nice and then go back into the mountains when it's bad again. It's been happening every year for 10 years. But it's all sitting in Pakistan.
And it's also the Arab Peninsula also plays a huge role in destabilizing Afghanistan. And there were some Afghans who complained about the Arab countries, like Kuwait and Saudi Arabia, creating madrasas that are trained, where they'll train orphans and young people and Wahhabi philosophy and things like that. the Mujahideen were touting a philosophy that is not Afghan. They learned it at Kabul University and during their travels to Egypt and things like that while they were attending Kabul University. Some of it was actually mixed with Leninism. Their philosophy, the Mujahideen philosophy and Taliban philosophy, are not Afghan philosophies. They're very foreign.
This is for either or both of you. I guess I'm just wondering, like, where you think these conversations and the experiences you had traveling back to Afghanistan are going to carry you in your ongoing work. I guess, Jacob, for you, like, in the touring that you're doing and talking to folks, especially in the U.S. South, and then Rock, for you, like, in your kind of ongoing interest in nonviolent movement.
Well, for me personally, it was, on a very personal level, it was a healing experience. And I feel better equipped to take on the type of work that we're doing emotionally. And I also have narratives of basically hillbillies in Afghanistan. They call themselves mountain boys. But, you know, stories about the rural life and how we're all planting potatoes at the same time are things that a lot of people I interact with in the South can understand. And putting a very human face on the people of Afghanistan, I think, will help generate some sympathy and maybe even some empathy in some rare situations as we travel and we're able to share these pictures and these stories that we have of this rural farming family and life that's on the other side of the pond in the mountains. So I think those will be very beneficial tools for us.
I'm really excited about the Afghan Youth Peace Volunteers and also Akhmadullah Arjewal. I'll try to tell you a bit about them. I'm probably going to tell you more than a bit. But so Arjewal actually used to work at the State Department in Afghanistan, but he quit. He read a book called Civilian Jihad, which was written by a woman named Maria Stefan, who worked for the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict, ICNC. And after reading that book about Civilian Jihad, is chapter after chapter of nonviolent struggles in Muslim countries. And one of these chapters is about Badshah Khan, which is that man in the middle, the microphone. He was one of Gandhi's best friends. His nickname was Frontier Gandhi, and he was a Pashtun from Western Pakistan. Pashtuns are the Taliban, in case you weren't aware. He would organize men who would usually carry rifles on each shoulder. Like, they were a revenge culture. They had been resisting the British for decades with insurgent tactics, and he convinced 100,000 of them to turn over their weapons and follow him on this nonviolent struggle called the Hudai Hitmatgar, which means the servants of God. And he would walk around from village to village teaching them how to be self-sustainable and self-reliant, just like these Afghan youth peace volunteers want. And he would teach them how to boycott and teach them how to strike and things like that. And whenever the British would come in, for example, they went into one village in Chardasa, which is really interesting because that's where the guy who rented out bin Laden's home is from. But they went to that village and they were trying to kick the Hudai Hitmatgar out and they wouldn't leave. They just stood their ground. And they threatened to mow them down with their cavalry, which was horses and cars, and they wouldn't move. They just put their shawls in their mouths to keep from screaming, and they were being run over by cars and horses and being trampled. They would take the muzzles of the gun and shove them in their chests and, like, beg them to kill them. And what happened is it frightened the British. They had no idea how to react because they couldn't control these people anymore. They couldn't control them with fear. They couldn't control them even with death. Nothing could put fear in these people, and so they were no longer controllable. And they were instrumental in getting the British to leave. Badshah Khan's history was sort of erased from that region's history because he did not support the partition of India and Pakistan. And he was from Western Pakistan, so Pakistan tried to snub his name out. Also because he supported a Pashtunistan. He had similar views with the Taliban. He wanted to create an autonomous Pashtunistan. And So this was a man who's in this chapter that R2L was reading about. And so there's potential to organize Pashtuns, especially now since we have this sort of technology. How he could organize 100,000 men back then without Facebook or anything is a miracle. But R2L started to do these civic mobilization trainings, he calls them, and he shows a force more powerful, which he dubbed in Pashto, which is all about Gandhi and Martin Luther King and Nelson Mandela and the Solidarity Movement in Poland. And he translated Civilian Jihad into Pashto. He also translated Canvas materials into Pashto. Canvas is the Center for Applied Nonviolent Action Strategies. And this is the group of Serbian Otpor youths that overthrew Milosevic. And they were the group that trained Egyptians before, because Egyptians realized that what they were doing wasn't working, so they sought outside help. Canvas helped them. And now, what happened was, I reached out to Canvas for a separate issue and told them about R2L, and they wanted to hear more. And now R2L and him and Canvas are in a conversation to talk about what they could do to help each other in Afghanistan. At that same time, the Afghan youth randomly sent me an email asking me if I could get them in contact with Canvas, even though they didn't even know that I was in touch with Canvas. And so now they're in touch with Canvas. And what's neat about the Afghan Youth Peace Volunteers is they've been trying to work with other tribes for a long time, especially Pashtun tribes, but they haven't been able to. They tried to send some Pashtun organizations gifts as like a solidarity gesture, and the reaction was just surprise that they got the gifts, but they didn't respond and form a relationship. R2L is Pashtun. And so this is a chance for the Afghan youth, which are Tajiks and Hazaras, to work with Pashtuns, which is sort of a revolutionary thing to happen in Afghanistan. And they both have very similar views. They want to form trainings all over Afghanistan. They want to train trainers, and they want to have seminars, and they want to go and reform curriculums in schools to include peace education. And what R2L actually wants to do is to get some Egyptians to come and help them train. And R2L really has clearly thought about this a long time. And he's thought of, and the Afghan Peace Volunteer, they really know what needs to be done. And I have a lot of faith in them. Both of them estimated the exact same time. They think it'll take 10 to 15 years before there could be some sort of national Tahrir Square or something like that. But they think that in the meantime, you can have these peace trainings and you can do nonviolent direct action on local levels, and that would be more effective to do on the local levels and get people practice in doing nonviolence and get people to feel comfortable with the idea that nonviolence actually works and it's not just naive. And then they can begin to build relationships with each other in solidarity, and then they can have a national movement. But it'll take a long time, they think. So that's what I just want to dedicate my time to working with those people and helping them gain contacts and get their name out and things like that. And we also, I'm on the board of IVAW, and there's a lot of questions in Iraq Friends Against the War. How do we deal with political changes? You know, Afghanistan is the big war now. Before it was Iraq. Do we need to change our name to Afghanistan and Iraq Friends Against the War? You know, what do we need to do? And so that's one of the things that I'm trying to focus on as a member of the board is what do we do within? We have a committee called Afghanistan Veterans Against the War. And the question is, what happens with this committee? What do we do? And there's uncertainty, but I think what's probably going to happen is we're going to get the Afghanistan veterans in IVAW to get together in some sort of forum where we can talk about what we think needs to happen. Personally, I feel like an Afghanistan veterans organization needs to form with its own vision, its own points of unity, its own structure and things like that, because it's a very different conflict.